The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is on at Sleep Outfitters. Save up to $1,000 store-wide with our lifetime price guarantee and 100% comfort guarantee. Why shop anywhere else? Limited time clearance savings only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com.
Welcome to the Jazz Shapers podcast from Mishkon Dorea. What you're about to hear was originally broadcast on Jazz FM. However, the music has been cut due to rights issues.
This is Jazz Shapers with Elliot Moss on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkon Dorea. It's business, but it's personal. Listening colour.
Welcome to Jazz Shapers with me, Elliot Moss, bringing the shapers of the business world together with the musician shaping jazz, soul and blues. My guest today is Elizabeth Rossiello, founder and CEO of Azza Finance, an African payments and foreign exchange fintech company. Try saying that too late at night. Beginning her career as a translator in the German parliament, Elizabeth speaks five languages. We're going to be conducting this interview in those five, just so you know. Buckle up and get ready for that. It was while working as a microfinance analyst in Nairobi that she saw the lack of financial infrastructure available for growing businesses, which was blocking their trade with neighbouring countries. Encouraged by a seed investor, Elizabeth launched BitPesa, as it was then known, in 2013 in Kenya, on a mission to power African trade by using blockchain to bypass traditional banking channels, enabling quick and cheap remittances. Rebranding to Azza Finance in 2019, they've since served over 2 million customers in over 190 countries with plans for further growth in Asia and Europe. Aren't many countries left, but there you go. Hello.
Hi.
Good to have you. What does an African payments and foreign exchange fintech company do?
We trade money. We trade currencies, 55 of them in Africa. And I always use the example, which is relevant to nobody but New Yorkers. If you couldn't send money between New York and New Jersey, how would you live? And often so many small African countries, large African countries, different currencies, lots of trade. And there were a lot of barriers to trading across the continent. Plus, most people on planet Earth will be African by the turn of the century. And so how do we connect Africa to the rest of the world? How do we trade with them? As we see, you know, the U.S. dollar may or may not be the main currency we trade in. So it was really exciting to work and build this company to allow payments across Africa and between Africa and the rest of the world.
The woman from Queens.
Yeah,
New
Queens
York.
Accent.
Queens accent. Yeah, but it's no, but it's dialed down a little bit. I mean, you could go full Queens
only
on me.
Because I'm on radio.
Exactly. I'm getting posh Elizabeth here.
And wait till my phone rings. My mom calls.
Mom. Yeah. Ma, how are you? Did you think in your wildest dreams that you would end up going to Nairobi, doing your thing, being a smart microfinance analyst? We'll come to what that really means, and then setting up your own business. Was this part of the Elizabeth plan?
No, not at all. And I always joke or, you know, cry about the idea that I only ever could dream a few, one or two steps ahead. And I talk a lot about representation and didn't have role models. I didn't know of anybody who had even worked abroad, much less, you know, even worked outside of New York City. Are you kidding me? You know, New York City was the center of my universe. So, you know, who works outside New York City? Who works even in Manhattan from Queens? You know, I had one aunt who had made it as a secretary in AT&T, and everybody's
like working girl.
Yeah. No, seriously. Literally. Like, well, she was a high-powered secretary. That's how he spoke about her. She had other secretaries work. She once typed up so-and-so's report. That was, you know, my role model as a kid. I didn't know what a lawyer did. You know, I'd never heard about anything like that. So I only, as I started to go to better schools and meet other kids and, you know, wealthier kids, different classes, people who travel, different parents, I started to be like, oh, wow, that's available. And I was just, you know, youngest child, last born, just greedy and detached, just kind of like, I could do anything. I could go anywhere, you know. Filial piety was done by the rest of my family, you know, the older sister. We say that a lot in the African continent. Number one has to stay. Number two has to support. And the last borns can just,
yeah,
you know, go do what they want.
But it is an extraordinary thing because often, again, the cliche as well, you're from New York, you're privilege is a big word, but you've come from a background that says it's inevitable that you go to a really good university, you went to Columbia and so on. But actually, in your instance, your case, not at all.
No, I'm from South Queens.
So how did it
South
happen,
Queens.
Though? But South Queens to here, this moment, massive journey.
Yeah.
What apart from being the detached, greedy third child that was allowed to go off and do whatever she wanted and not really notice, what else do you think is the reason why we're having this conversation?
My parents, teachers, I don't know, people, heroes along the way that plucked me out. You know, I went to these free programs in my public school or state school, as you call it here in the UK, for like gifted kids. And each one of the teachers there was like, we're going to do a thing where we, you know, write reports on a new computer program, which no one had used before. And we're going to have the creator of the computer program come in and teach you guys, New York City public school students, how to use it. I'm going to take you to the Joyce Theater, which is an incredible modern dance theater in Manhattan, once a month. Or the Met once a month for 2 years, and we're going to go see these special performances for students. And I just, you know, luckily when you're in an urban area, you do have special things like that. And when I, later on when I worked in sub-Saharan Africa in rural areas, I was like, where's your teacher who takes you to the museum? You know, yeah, your dad's a jerk, your mom has no money, but like where are these teachers? Where are these other services? And then I was like, oh, they don't exist in these markets. And so the private market is even more important. So we can say what we want about the U.S., but I think, you know, the public school system in New York City is, you know, gave me a lot of opportunities.
I mentioned Lin-Manuel Miranda. You were at school with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Lin-Manuel Miranda is the writer of many musicals, In the Heights, Hamilton. I'm going to forget the rest of them. There's just too many. He's prolific.
Moana. He wrote Moana. Moana. Are you kidding? My 5-year-old's obsessed.
How could I forget Moana?
Yeah.
And so many others. An actor. I mean, he's a polymath and he's brilliant. He directed you and you're a great dancer, but you shouldn't sing.
I mean,
Give me the
Hunter
story.
College High School, which is, you know, a pretty big high school in New York City in Manhattan for the arts. They do a lot of musicals and things like that. And amongst other things. And I was always a ballet dancer and I wanted to be in the musicals, and Lin was great. And he was always the assistant director, the director. And he'd be like, come to the front of the stage. Beth, that's what they called me then. He's like, Beth, great. Front of the stage. Lip sync. No sound. We don't want to hear any sounds coming out of you. And, you know, I think that was maybe one of the first lessons where you're like, I'm good at some things. I'm not good at all things. And it doesn't mean I need to hide in a corner. You know, it just means I need to do what I'm good at.
So what are you good at? Now that you're in business running your own show.
I talk a lot about, you know, having a voice and having a direction and answering the question of what do you want? What's the answer to this question? And, you know, really trying to think of, you know, not being in the middle where you're wavering in the middle. And just today, the last few days, I've been doing this big strategic plan and talking to people like, oh, we could go halfway or we could do a little bit. And I'm like, that's confusing. So how do you have a strong direction, especially as a leader? You know, and when we have a direction that's unpopular, like let's support women or, you know, let's focus on sub-Saharan Africa or let's use a new technology like Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies when it was popular, you know, a lot of people come at you. But if you have that vision, of course, supported by facts and, you know, product marketing, et cetera, I think that's so important because every day a lot of people are going to tell you they don't like your voice or, you know, you should be quiet. And if you want to build something, and if you want to do something new, you have to have that voice inside of you. And so you need to have your own inner direction. Does that make sense?
And of course, there's Newton's third law of motion. Every action has a reaction. You seem like you're the kind of person that says, well, I know that. Thanks for telling me, Elliot. I already know Newton's first and second and third law because I'm very smart. But you don't seem to mind. So where's that lack of worry, or is there worry?
Oh, of course there's worry. Okay. You know, of course at night, you know, I always joke, I'm like, talk to yourself in the mirror. I say that to an employee. I'm like, go talk it out with yourself in the mirror.
You do that as well.
Come
I do
in.
That.
Of course, everybody
yeah,
does
we'll
it.
We'll do that.
And then come in and tell your team the tough news. So, of course, there's all that nonsense that happens with my, you know, my friends or my partner or my diary or wherever. You let it out. But on stage or at work, you know, you got to get it together, especially if you're a leader. Now, of course, you can ask questions with your trusted people. I just think, you know, a lot of people look towards, sorry for the listeners, like investors. Tell me what to think. What should I do? And investors will come and tell you, you know what? I just met you. This meeting's 4 minutes in. Why don't you change your entire business model? I know nothing about the sector. And by the way, I just graduated from business school. But clearly, and they'll say it with direction. And if you don't have your own direction, that wind will blow you over. And I think if you're building a product and you're certain about it and you know, you have your product market fit, you're the one who knows your business, you've talked to your clients, you've worked in the field, at least in my case, I worked in the field, I knew the clients, I knew the problem, I knew the team, I saw the data, so I've got to make sure that the ship steers forward. And I think a lot of young founders say, oh, well, this investor wants this or that investor wants this or I'm worried about, you know, projecting too much of that. And you lose that very strong sense of director, which makes people follow a CEO, makes people a leader. and makes a business keep going over the years.
Create followership. Much more going to be coming up from my guest, Elizabeth Rossiello, in a couple of minutes. Don't go anywhere.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM.
In partnership with Mishkondorea.
It's business, but it's personal.
You can enjoy all our former Business Shapers on the Jazz Shapers podcast, and you can hear this very program again with Elizabeth if you pop Jazz Shapers into your favorite podcast platform. My guest today is Elizabeth Rossiello, founder and CEO of Azza Finance, an African payments and foreign exchange fintech company. This journey that you took and then the world of microfinance, just in English, describe what microfinance is before we go into all the other the other bits.
It's a very big sector, but in the end, it's small amounts of finance. So bank accounts with small amounts in them, loans with small amounts in them, you know, asset financing, house mortgages with a little bit of money. So I think when we were first doing it, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for establishing Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. And his idea
part of the Telenor company. Is that that one? Grameen was part of, was it connected to the telecoms business?
Afterward, it started to use mobile money to pay out.
Right.
But originally, and this is a concept all over the world, South America, even Germany, West Africa, they call them susus.
Yeah.
A bunch of women get in a group and they all save a little bit of money and they help each other save. Another way could be a merry-go-round where every month everybody puts in $5 and they give the whole amount to one woman. And maybe every 10 months it's your turn to get the big sum. That's called a merry-go-round. There's a lot of permutations of this. That's the way it's that started, these community savings groups. When there is no banking available because you live in a poor area or you're female, then you create your own little banking sewing circles groups. And they kind of developed into bigger and bigger things. And in Bangladesh, Grameen Bank formalized and it became one of the biggest banks. And there was also in Mexico, Compartamos, which then had the IPO, which
was
a big deal.
We share, literally, Compartamos.
Yeah. And then, you know, all across Africa, people started investing in them, saying, this is the new kind of social investing. It's like, instead of donating, we invest in a business that makes money. And we'll help these businesses across the continent or across the world. And then we feel a little less guilty about donating money. And so microfinance became this huge sector where you had a lot of international donors and a lot of data. I was a ratings analyst. Now I think a lot of that's morphed into fintech. And a lot of telcos and a lot of fintechs are now offering microfinancial services. So I have a lot of friends that run fintechs, and they have taken the place of these community banks and, you know, maybe digitized it. But traditionally, it was done pretty low tech.
I read somewhere this kind of you being an analyst in this space, then morphing into someone saying, why don't you set your own thing up? And I'm shortening years of your life in a sentence there. Did you need the nudge? Had you ever thought about setting up your own thing?
Yeah, I would meet with Charlene, who is we started the company together. She's here in London now. And, you know, back in the day, we'd meet weekly in Nairobi and we'd be like, everybody around us is starting their own thing. Why don't we start our own thing? You know, why can't we do this? And then we're like, oh, well, we just don't have the entrepreneurial spirit, or I'm just not a singer, you know? And then this one guy said, there is no entrepreneurial bone in your body. You just do it.
And do you believe that? Do you think that's right?
100%. I think you just do it if you want to. I think people find other reasons not to do it. It's a privilege to do an entrepreneur. You don't make a lot of money in the beginning. So I had to be in a position where, you know, I had saved some money or I had no other choice. I wasn't making any money anyway at that time.
You weren't?
No, I had just had two kids and I was really struggling to find a job again.
Interesting. So there was no choice for
you
as you
saw
it.
Yeah, why not? I was already at rock bottom. So I think people say, you know, can you do it? Yeah, anybody can do it. Do you want to do it? It's like going to the gym. Anybody can go to the gym. Will everybody go to the gym and be successful? No. Could anybody, unless you have, you know, a physical impairment, probably you could go.
Can I ask you a question, Elizabeth? I can ask you a question because this is what we do.
I asked you signed up for that, yes.
And you signed up for it and you went, yes, I will, Elliot. I will do that. It feels like to me, just looking at the way your life has gone, well, I was the gifted kid and I was put in here and I went to that and I did this. The doors keep on opening, but you keep on pushing through them. Not because you're premeditated, not because you're more than one step ahead, but just because you're there. Was it like that in that moment? Was there anything big to you about the decision to set up a business? Or was it just like all the other decisions that you made along the way?
Well, I was just turning 30, so hopefully I was a little bit more self-aware at that point.
No, but I don't mean in a sort of, but did you did you realize the enormity of what you were sort of signing
up
for?
No, I was like, I just need to do something to get paid. You know, I need a job. I want to create my own job. And also, I was just really sick. I talk about this a lot. I was just sick of working with toxic people. I had just, after working in microfinance, I had been working in kind of consultancies in Kenya. And I worked at one where they sent an email that said something very racist and very awful. And I said, I can't work here with these people. This isn't my values. You know, I'm a capitalist. I worked at Goldman Sachs, but I can't have this. I can't have somebody say something so wild in an email with my name on it. And so I quit in an act of no. And then I was like, well, now I'm broke. So, you know, how do I have values and pay my rent? I guess I have to create my own company, you know? And I think that's where I really was at as well. And so I think a lot of founders hit the wall. Either the problem they're solving is something that's really hurt them. You know, I couldn't find this thing in the market and I need it, or this happened to me and this will save me now. And I'm building this so that other people don't have what I had. Or you're really like, you know, I need to move forward and I need to feed my family, or I need to get this going, or my dad's yelling at me to get a job and I need to think of something quick, and you build it yourself. Now, some people would just say, well, let me just apply for another job. I was in Kenya. It wasn't as easy at the time to get work, you know, so I won't say that, you know, I had to do it. But I think I had also been the benefit of a lot of entrepreneurial spirit that was happening around me. And one thing about moving to sub-Saharan Africa in 2009, was everybody was running these small businesses. And in microfinance, I had seen women with nothing. And I'd been to their houses because I had counted their assets part of the job. And I would say, like, you have literally nothing and you're starting a business? And that was inspiring. So all of that was in my head. And I think if I have to credit someone, I'd credit all these women who I visited and worked with who were making something out of nothing.
It's almost like the broken windows theory in reverse. It was all around you and you felt empowered and you did it. And we're here talking about that. It's Elizabeth Rossiello and she's my business shaper today. She's the CEO and founder of Azza Finance. You've built a big team. How many people work for you today?
Well, at our peak, we were 250. Then yeah. We slimmed down in the last cycle. Now we're 130.
Do you think you manage them in a way that is, well, you talked about values, which I want to come on to, in a way that reflects your upbringing? Has that ever, does it?
Yeah, good and bad. I think at the beginning, I was a little Queens. I was a little loud.
And what is a little Queens? Loud.
A little bit loud.
In your face.
Well, I think I was learning how to communicate. I mean, I just came out of investment banking. And then I had worked in the field doing field work where I was listening a lot. And this is my first time, you know, building a team together. And I didn't know how to keep some of my stress out of the office, you know. And that's something I talked to other CEOs and founders a lot. What are you doing on your brain, on your body, on your family, on your friends? And then you come into the office and you're on stage. You have to perform peak professional performance. And you talk to a lot of the biggest CEOs in the world. And I always quote this, like, Harvard Business Review article I read, which mapped out the day of like five of the biggest CEOs. All of them were either religious or really into meditation or into spirituality or like therapy.
Because
you need to fix that part of your body. Then they all did something physical, then they all did something with their kids or their spouse. Then they all had a gatekeeper that protected their schedule. Then they all did things that like nourished them. And then they were like peak performance.
Yeah. You need all those things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just going to be on the wheel and you're going to be spinning and spinning.
Yeah. And I had a 1 and a 2-year-old when I started the company. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no money. And we were doing something where everywhere we went, people were like, what? Bitcoin, huh?
Well, I was going to say Bitcoin. I mentioned blockchain as well very early.
2013, it was nobody was doing this.
Nobody.
We went to the Central Bank of Kenya and the guy was like, who is Mr. Bitcoin? I mean, it's like an internal company joke forever. Geez. And we're like,
Donald Trump.
No, I was so stupid. Then I was like, it's all of us. And I was like, oh, that's such a bad answer. Yeah. Then he was
What is this, the Matrix?
Let me do this again. Yeah. You know, nobody knew what we were talking about. It was no positive feedback, I'd say.
So that balancing out, those things we just talked about, the spinning wheels from the Harvard Business Review.
To kind of
but what do you do now to manage all those bits?
Well, first of all, I grew up. I've been through it all. And, you know, after a first couple of typhoons hit the company, you know, we had this big battle with the Central Bank of Kenya, the big battle with Safaricom. I moved the whole company to Nigeria at one point. We bought a company in South Africa. We had an explosion with FTX. I mean, a million things happened along the way. And now when I see the typhoon coming, I'm like, oh, that is a typhoon. It shall come. And then it'll be over. And the team is always like, what? Aren't you going to? And I'm like, nope. And now my senior managers, and a lot of them have been with me 7-8 years now. I think our senior team is together on average 8 years. And the next level of like 45 people has been there over 6 years. You know, we all really stick together. And now we have this calm in the face of volatility. And we trade currencies. and we trade emerging market currencies. So volatility is our daily bread. So you have to be calm in the face of volatility. Now, how do you become calm in the face of volatility? Are you a cowboy with no nerve endings? A lot of founders are. Maybe I was in the beginning. Then I realized maybe that's not a sustainable way.
No.
So how are you calm in the face of volatility? You have inner calm. You know, you use your judgment. You plan. You do scenario planning. So all these things help me be such a better manager over the years. And I think,
is there a silver bullet on in the face of volatility? If there was one thing above everything else, Elizabeth, that you would preach, what is it?
Go to the data. You know, yes, there's volatility, but look at the data that, you know, this will turn. This is a cycle. What goes up must come down. And in all good markets, things must go down. And so you have to remember that. It's not a healthy market if it just goes up.
And right? On that cheery note, Elizabeth will be back for our final chat. And we've also got some music from Professor Longhair. That's in just a moment. Make sure you don't go down too far.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM.
In partnership with Mish Kondareya.
It's business. But it's personal.
Elizabeth Rossiello is my business shaper just for a few more minutes. Accolades galore, I say to you. Most influential women in payments, American Banker 2025, FinTech Leader of the Year, London FinTech Awards, Inspiring Leader, this and that, and top 30. Pretty cool, huh? Does it make any difference for you?
I think it makes a big difference because there's so few female founders in FinTech. FFF, you know, there's like really none of us. And there were even fewer 13 years ago when I started. And a lot of investors and people in the press or other founders still to this day tell me, stop talking about the female thing, or like, enough with the female thing, or are you complaining? And I'm like, no, I am reporting from the front line, you know, so.
And advocating, because you're not just reporting.
Yeah.
And does that advocacy ever end?
No, and it gets louder. Now that I'm older, we're at the cycle where we're looking to exit. And, you know, 13 years in, there's a lot of consolidation happening in the market. Now is the chance to use my voice. And I think, obviously, I'm not one to be quiet in general, but I did hold my tongue quite a few times in the early years. And, you know, it's hard. And I think one thing that excites me about building my own business is that it does give me a platform to speak out for people who I haven't had that opportunity. And a lot of women come up to me at conferences, you know, in the bathroom, like, oh, you really inspired me, or I didn't know that before you, or I saw your video, or things like that. That keeps me going, you know? And I think when we see these awards, does it mean much? No, obviously. I got a lot more compliments on one of those awards than when I graduated from college, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's like when I bought my first car, my dad was more excited than when I graduated college. He was like, wow, nice car.
Look what she's done.
Yeah.
She can afford a car.
He's sending it to his friends.
But it sounds like I'm going to use the phrase, be more queens. You're more queens now than you probably were comfortable being when you...
Well, I don't think I could ever shake my queensness. But I think what I am now is I talk more about... I think I always talked about queens because that was clear. I am from there. But I didn't talk about being female enough, I don't think. And I talked a lot about being white in Africa, and I talked a lot about race, I talked a lot about class, and now I'm realizing a lot of it's female too. And, you know, those three center points I see all the time, everywhere I go, and I think it's hard not to talk about it. And now, I was just saying, we were sharing notes that I just saw Sherry Blair speak, and she said to this group of executive women that I'm a part of, she goes, pretty much now the only thing I give extra time to is things that are involving gender. And a lot of these C-suite women who have very little time are like, if someone asks me to volunteer, I'm like, what's it about? So, you know, I don't know what that says, whether we're getting more closed off or in tough times when funding dries up and, you know, underrepresented areas get it less, people feel it more. Or maybe we just have more outlets, like I have this podcast and, you know, I have a lot of podcasts and now we have the ability to say what we want. Mm. And so people are actually talking about it.
And if there was to be a time with more time, what's Elizabeth going to do with her time in that future state?
Well, now I think it's exciting. I'm doing a lot of mentoring, which is cool because a lot of people will ask me these very simple questions to me. And to them, they're like, I had no idea. And then I'm like, just do this. And they're like, oh, so helpful. And I'm thinking back to the time when people kind of took the lid off a lot of that stuff for me. So paying it forward. Paying it backwards, you know, paying it all around, just sharing what we've been through. I think there's a lot of glorification of the founder story. you know, oh, it's so amazing. And then you're a billionaire, you know, or we're like, he sleeps 1 hour a night. Wow. You know, you're like, that's a terrible idea. You know, nobody should be in charge of other people if they're sleeping 1 hour a night, you know, or he doesn't wear shoes. Wow. You know, how cool is that?
You're talking about my last 10 guests. I don't know. This is terribly pejorative.
It's like if they haven't showered and they can't cut their toenails, they shouldn't be in charge of other humans. You know, like I think if I saw another mother or another father at the school run who like was unshowered and hadn't cut their nails and, you know, was like, I sleep 1 hour every night, you might call child services, right? So why do we think that's what somebody should do as a founder? And I knew another woman who was at Goldman Sachs forever, and she started a company, and she's like, it's a scam. I would have been so many more millions if I'd stayed at Goldman. They tell me that starting a company is going to make me wealthy and I'm going to do all this stuff, but all of these VCs come in and the offers they're giving you and the terms they're giving you, it's almost impossible to get your head out above water. And I think we have to remember that out of a lot of founders, very few make it all the way. And I think not only am I one of the only females, I'm one of the very few who's gone over a decade. And in Africa, of the fintechs that I started with, my cohort, very few are still there. And, you know, I'm good friends with those founders, but there's a lot of bodies on the side of the road because I think it was not only very early for the African continent, but very early for a lot of the infrastructure, a lot of the investment cycle. So I am quite proud. And a lot of these awards speak to that. It took a long time to get our name out there.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you for your honesty. Thank you for being from Queens. I can't imagine you any other way. Just before we let you disappear into your future state, which I'm sure you would enjoy immensely, what's your song choice and why have you chosen it?
Take the A Train. My brother used to play this on the saxophone all the time. And I live between the J train and the A train. So, and I went from Queens all the way to Harlem to school, and I spent sometimes 2 to 3 hours on the train every day from age 12 to 18. So here we go.
Duke Ellington there with Take the A Train, the song choice of my business shaper today, Elizabeth Rossiello. What's the answer to the question? Have a view, because that is the point of being a leader. Go to the data. In the face of volatility, be calm, but the way to be calm is to actually root your answer and your view of things in the data itself. And finally, in her view, people are not born entrepreneurs. They become entrepreneurs, sometimes because they have to, and sometimes because the opportunity is just too good to refuse. But be under no illusions, it ain't easy. Really honest take on life as a founder. That's it from me and Jazz Shapers. Have a lovely weekend.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM.
In partnership with Mishkondareya.
It's business, but it's personal.
We hope you enjoyed that edition of Jazz Shapers. You'll find hundreds more guests available for you to listen to in our archive. To find out more, just search Jazz Shapers in iTunes or your favourite podcast platform, or head over to mishkon.com/Jazz Shapers.